It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Still ahead, a new report says schools desegregation in the South has slowly withered away in the 60 years since the separate but equal laws were overturned. We'll find out what's happened.
But first, in the mid-1980s, compact discs began to flood record stores, marking the beginning of the digital music era and rendering vinyl records nearly obsolete.
But with the recent rise of vinyl record sales, this stubborn format has made a surprising comeback, and independent record stores are at the center of it.
Tomorrow is Record Store Day, and Dave Zero, owner of Mad City Music Exchange, joins us in the studio now to tell us more about it. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So tomorrow is Record Store Day, National Record Store Day, I take it.
Yes.
What happens on National Record Store Day?
Record Store Day is basically a celebration of record stores and independent businesses, record stores across the nation, if they want to participate in it. Most do. There's always a few that don't. They have a lot of special limited edition releases for sale, and it's kind of up to the individual record store if they're going to participate and how they're going to participate. My store, we have live bands playing. We'll have buskers out front. We have giveaways. We'll have... It's a big day. We open up early. We stay late. It's a big hooray for us, and I'm proud to be part of it. Really,
how did it begin?
It began about 7 years ago. I'm a little fuzzy on the exact details. It was basically just a great idea from a couple folks out on the East Coast. They saw the decline of record stores happening over the past 5 or 6 years. Right around 2000 is when there was a big record store day death watch. Record stores were going down and left and right, and they wanted to do something to try to rally the troops. And it was good timing because Record Store Day started just about the same time record stores actually started to rally themselves. People were learning how to make a business and how to make a living with record stores while juggling this new way of media, juggling the new way of music that's happening.
Well, and it's a bit ironic. We see the rise of iTunes and other digital media, digital downloads, and yet people are waiting for the next new releases to now come out on vinyl. How did that evolve?
Devolve? I feel in a way it's kind of a reaction to having everything so readily available online. I mean, technically, if you would, record stores don't need to be there, but a lot of music fans want them, and that's why we're still around. People's reaction to being able to have everything so quickly and so digital, a real music fan is going to go in and they're going to buy their album. They're going to buy their CD. They're going to buy their vinyl. It sounds better, and it kind of shows that you actually are a music fan. When you want to take this music and you want to bring it into your home, you make it part of your life. And you just don't get the same experience with an MP3 or being able to download something on your phone, listen to it once or twice. There's really nothing there. There's nothing actual or tangible to hold on to. And it's great. It's showing that the actual record is an art form. It's not just a piece of disposable media. Mm-hmm. It's an actual art form.
And what about the sound of the actual records themselves? I've heard people say that the sound is just warmer and has more character, and that you'll never get it in digital media. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, it's a cliche because it's true. Anything that's analog is going to sound better than digital. Anytime you put something digital, it's going to compress. It's just the nature of digital. As long as the record is mastered properly, as long as the album was recorded properly, put on the vinyl, it's always going to sound better. I do think technology has gone to a time when remastering albums is really good on CD, and I think there's a lot of really great sounding CDs, but it's always going to be close. It's always going to be just close to the vinyl sound, and you'll never be able to actually capture that because it's a digital.
But the appeal of vinyl seems to be like just a narrow fraction of the entire music market. And I'm curious, A, if that's true, and B, if it's enough to keep record stores alive.
Yes, definitely. It is a narrow fraction, but music in general has so fractioned in the past 10 to really 15 years that anything works. I mean, it's a small fraction, but music sales just aren't the same as they used to be. And if people actually want to buy vinyl, they'll be coming forward with that, I believe.
And who buys the most vinyl at your store? Is it just hipsters with fancy beards, or is it regular people?
Well, we do appreciate our beardos that come in. It's everyone. We have the we have the older generation that have been there and never gave up with it. They've been buying records and used records since, you know, the 60s and 70s. There's a whole crew of kids that are 30 and under that all their new releases are sold to them. They, again, it goes back to the idea of, like, they're, you know, showing that they are the music fan because they want to bring everything in. It's all over the board, really. There's people that, like me, who were in a weird generation. I started buying vinyl right out of high school, right in high school, because it was cheap. Yeah, I could find, you know, I would go to Goodwill and be able to find my entire Ramones collection for a couple bucks. I remember the day I found my Elvis Costello and Neil Young for $12 and their entire collection. But now, I kind of grew up with it. So there are people that were buying vinyl. They want to stay with vinyl. They have some CDs. It's the music fan's a picky person, and they always enjoy the option of having vinyl or
CDs. Sounds like you speak from experience.
Yeah,
your vinyl.
I like to play it down, but really, there's no way around it.
If we were to listen to an album on vinyl to convert us, you know, away from our MP3s, what do you think is a record that just sounds so much better on vinyl than it does on
MP3 question.
Or CD or something?
Yeah, that's a very good question. An old Neil Young record. Just about, he is such an audiophile that all his records were mastered so well. You can, it jumps out of the speakers. If you have even mediocre speakers, old Neil Young records will sound fantastic, even if they're all beat up and crackly. There's a lot of newer stuff that sounds good. I would go for the old stuff first, a really nice copy of an old Neil Young record. Even stuff like the Stones or any classic rock. That's when they were still mastering records properly.
It's nice people can go and take advantage of the fact that another one person's junk is another person's treasure. And there are a lot of old vinyl records out there in resale shops and everything. And so if you want to find an old record, you can usually find them for cheap because people discarded them. They thought, oh, vinyl's going away. I'm going to buy the CD version of this.
That's exactly why I started buying vinyl to begin with. Now there is definitely, since there is a resurgence, the vinyl prices, of course, have gone up a little bit. And it's interesting because more people want vinyl now, probably within the last 20 years. But there's almost a little bit less to go around. So you have to kind of search for it. The prices have gone up a little bit, but you can still find decent stuff. I mean, we put out, I would guess we put out at least 1,000 used records every month, over 1,000 used records every month. And the only problem we have with them is making sure we can price them in time. I mean, we're constantly selling out of them because it's great. I mean, we have a crowd. We know how to, let our crowd know that things are happening. You know, the records are coming out, what the new releases are. And it's, again, it's just kind of all independent businesses is a juggling act. And we've learned how to juggle that and sell to our audience, and people love the vinyl again.
How do you feel about sort of the nostalgic aspects of vinyl? If it's not retro for you, then it's nostalgic. And then, you know, for me, it's sort of the needle hitting and the little bit of crackle before the music starts. Do you think that's part of the appeal?
Oh, totally. Yeah, completely. It's a part of the appeal. There's so many reasons people go to vinyl. There's so many reasons it's music, so it's in an emotional response. And it's you're naturally going to be drawn to it. And there's many, many different reasons why people have emotional responses to anything. Some people, it's opening the sound of a cracking book. You know, the first time you open it, that way you feel like you own the book. So a lot of people feel the same way with a record. The first time you open a record, you hear that crack and you know you're the first one to use it. Or when you drop the needle on, it's an emotional response. So comes from many different directions.
And one quick question about care. I'm sure a lot of people want to get the most out of their record. How should we care for our records so they don't get scratched or broken?
There's a lot of ways. You can check out our website, madcitymusic.net, and we actually have a special, you know, getting back into vinyl and vinyl care tips that has a lot of information on there. You know, we especially set that up since there are so many new people into vinyl. Don't touch it on the inside. Hold it around the edges of the vinyl. Don't let your roommates touch it. That in my personal experience, never let your roommates touch it. I've lost a lot of great records that way.
And roommates, I'm sure.
Exactly. Try to keep it clean. It's all over the board. You know, treat it like it's something. It's important. Treat it like have fun with it, but treat it like it's something you want to keep sounding nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, again, sorry for the plug. MadCityMusic.net is, you know, we have all this vinyl information on how to keep your vinyl in good shape.
And so what are you looking forward to most tomorrow?
Oh, wow. What am I looking forward to? It's such a fun day. I'm looking forward to seeing everyone because it's such a great combination of our regulars and new people. We have people that travel from Milwaukee up north, Wisconsin, Illinois. They try to make the rounds. We've got a lot of great record stores in town. I'm always looking forward to seeing kids showing up on their first record store day. I've talked to a lot of folks about, you know, there's always a new crop of kids who are really excited because it's their first time. And, you know, I love seeing those guys come back. We have some great bands playing mm-hmm. at 2 o'clock, Building on Buildings and the Dharma Dogs, some buskers outside. It's more of a party atmosphere. It's a lot of work, but it's a really great feeling by the end of the day, seeing so many people come in and just, you know, being happy to be there with you.
Yeah, it's certainly an experience. Well, Dave, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Dave Zero, owner of Mad City Music Exchange in Madison. In 1954, the Supreme Court decided in the Brown versus Board of Education case that separate could not be equal and that schools across the country could not segregate students based on race.
It took decades after the ruling to see significant changes, but schools in the South did eventually set out to purposefully desegregate public education. Separate white and black high schools in some cases were closed and reopened as integrated schools.
Reports in recent years have shown that integration had a clear positive impact on increasing racial equality and closing the school achievement gap.
A new report out by ProPublica, however, shows that American schools, particularly in the South, are resegregating. Today in states like Alabama, a quarter of all black students attend white schools where 1% or less of the student body is white.
Here with us to discuss her report in ProPublica is reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones. Nicole, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So how racially segregated were American schools before Brown versus Board of Education? If you could just give us a bit of a historical context here.
Okay. Well, in the South, of course, it was complete segregation. There, by law, there were no black kids except maybe small numbers in Louisiana attending schools with white children at all. In other parts of the country, there was also very high segregation, particularly in the Northeast and the Midwest, though it was often by policy and not by law. But never in the history of our country have half of black students attended schools that were majority white, even though the black population of this country has usually always hovered around about 13%.
Mm-hmm. And segregation, talk about how it was enforced and then conversely how desegregation was enforced for a while.
Well, I mean, again, in the South, it was the law. So mm-hmm. it was enforced the way that any law was enforced. But also there was a very strict racial caste, and black parents were not attempting to cross it when it came to schools down there. But what happens after Brown is really for the first 10 years in the South, there was very little enforcement of the mandate to integrate the schools. Then we see the passage of the 64 Civil Rights Act, and that's really when you start to see real desegregation coming, because for the first time, the federal government could actually sue school districts and enforce Brown that way. And because of these court orders, in a very short period of time, you go from 1963, where just 2% of black children in the South were attending school with white kids, to in the early 70s, where 90% of black kids were attending schools that at least had some white children. So that is a huge difference in a very short period of time.
What was that first statistic?
In 1963, 2% of black children in the South were attending schools with white children.
And in your report, you look specifically at Central High School in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. How did desegregation take place there?
So Tuscaloosa had first been placed under a desegregation order in 1969, but like many districts in the South, it went to kind of a neighborhood schools or freedom of choice plan. And of course, the neighborhood school attendance zones were generally drawn in ways that maintained segregation. So in 1979, Tuscaloosa's two high schools were still pretty much segregated. There was an almost entirely black high school and a predominantly white high school, and a federal court ordered the merger of those two high schools into one, and that high school became Central. So if you were a public high school student in Tuscaloosa, you all went to the same school. So in that way, it was perfectly integrated.
And that high school has a significant place in history as it pertains to this. Talk a little bit about that and why you chose to focus on that school.
So you hear a lot about kind of the horrors of integration, but Tuscaloosa managed to make it work. This high school became the second largest high school in the state, and it quickly became a powerhouse, and it became a powerhouse athletically, but also academically. It was winning statewide math competitions. It had lots of national merit scholarships. It had award-winning debate teams. So they really managed to create a high school that academically was a success story, and that allow the children in the community to really focus their unity around one school.
And how did they do that exactly? I mean, could you connect the dots for us on how desegregation had a direct relationship with these successes?
Well, because before, the schools were separate, and as we know in the history of this country, separate has never been made equal. So prior to that, the white school was a larger school. It had better facilities. It had a more rigorous curriculum. It had better textbooks. And the black school, while it was a source of community pride, did not have the extent of these things. So bringing all of these schools together, it actually helped both white and black students, because when you have a large high school, you're simply able to offer more because all of the resources, instead of being split, are now going into one school. So this school was able to offer a wide array of classes. They had all of the best teachers because all the teachers were at one school. So it ended up being really a powerhouse because instead of the resources being divided, they were combined. But also the loyalties of a community were not attached to two separate high schools. They were all attached to one school because everyone's mm-hmm. kid was at the same place.
And yet, if we fast forward the clock a little bit to the year 2000, you say that it seems to be reversing in a way, and that in Tuscaloosa today, nearly one in three black students that attends a school, it looks as if Brown versus Board of Education never happened. Explain that.
Well, it would be wrong to say that desegregation was easy and that there weren't casualties. And one of the casualties in Tuscaloosa was a lot of white parents pulled out of the Tuscaloosa city schools. And so the city schools went from a majority white system to a majority black system. And city leaders were concerned that the system would eventually turn all black and that that would be a detriment to the community. So in 1998, they asked to be released from their federal court order, which then would free them up to run the district however they wanted to. And they were released and almost immediately split Central into three high schools, one of which they drew the attendance line so that it would be all black.
And you refer to the term apartheid schools. What does that mean?
So apartheid schools is a term that some academics use to describe schools that are 1% or less white. And in Tuscaloosa, they created an all-black feeder system so that for a third of students in the city from kindergarten to graduation, they can never have a white classmate. Those schools are all between 99 and 100% black.
I'm curious if maybe it's too soon to tell, but perhaps not. You point to some of the academic successes that came after the integration of Central High School in Tuscaloosa. Have you seen any reports now on these achievements or not as the school starts to segregate once again?
Absolutely. So nationally, integration peaked in 1988, and the achievement gap across the country had been narrowing to that point. And after integration peaks, the achievement gap widened, and it's remained wide. We have not been able to really shrink the gap. And in Tuscaloosa, what has happened is that feeder system of all black schools have been low performing. Many of the schools have been labeled failing schools. And so you're seeing kind of the same thing. And what's been shown is those schools are not getting the most experienced teachers, are not getting the same rigorous curriculum. And so those kids are really, overall, they show that kids who attend segregated schools by the time they enter high school are 3 years behind.
We're speaking with Nicole Hannah-Jones of ProPublica about her new report that some American schools are resegregating through gerrymandering and white flight.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're back with Nicole Hannah-Jones of ProPublica, and we're talking about her new report that some American schools are resegregating.
And we'd like to hear from you. Are you familiar with schools that have homogenous populations, maybe that didn't used to in the past? And why do you think it seems to be happening all over again? Do you see this trend happening in Wisconsin, maybe at a school that is near where you live? Why do you think it's happening? 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Nicole, we have been talking a lot about Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and their Central High School, since that's the focal point of your study. But I did want to ask whether or not this is an issue that's specific to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, or the South, or is it a nationwide issue?
Oh, it's definitely a nationwide issue. And I think I want to make clear to your listeners, the focus on the South was because the South actually did go through a lot of integration, and it became the most integrated region of the country. Mm-hmm. But that other parts of the country, particularly the Midwest, where your listeners are, and the Northeast, they've never really undergone extensive desegregation. And those are actually the two most segregated regions of the country for Black students.
We have a caller on the line. Marianne in Waukesha is with us. Hi, Marianne.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I know in many urban schools that behavior issues are a huge problem, and the teacher spends, you know, much of the time that he or she could be teaching trying to get the students under control. And I think many parents are very uncomfortable with that and pull their children out of public school and put them in parochial, not because of religious instruction, but because they don't want them exposed to these behavior issues and actually maybe learning that type of behavior.
And, okay, Nicole, what's your reaction to that? Is that a factor here in what's driving this resegregation of our schools?
I think the perception that these schools are somehow dangerous or that there are behavior problems definitely drives it. And I'm sure that there are behavior problems in public schools, just like there are behavior problems in any schools. And when you have kids, I mean, that's the point of public schools, is kids from all different backgrounds and parts of your area are going to attend the schools. But I think that a lot of times there is a perception problem that is a lot greater than the reality. For instance, in Tuscaloosa, with Central High School, the perception is that this is a violent, dangerous school. But I spent weeks in that school, and it was a very orderly school. And it was a very orderly school with kids who, even though they were behind, were very eager to learn. So I think we're never going to see schools where there are no issues, but we don't have a world where there are no issues. And public schools prepare your students to live in the real world.
Your study on the resegregation of the Tuscaloosa school says, you say that it's a story of the city's financial interests, secret meetings, and angry public votes. And I'm wondering if we can dig into all three of those one at a time here, starting with the city's financial interests.
So there were really two things. There was a lot of concern among city officials that if the white population in the schools declined, then white residents would also want to start leaving the city as well and go to other areas where they trusted the schools. So there was that concern because, of course, that erodes your tax base. And then there was also the concern about Tuscaloosa had been trying to attract an automobile plant, and they'd lost the Saturn plant, and they believe that they lost the Saturn plant because of the schools. And so a few years later, Mercedes was looking to build a plant there, and city officials and business leaders were determined that they were not going to lose the plant because of the schools again. And that was part of the effort to create a pocket of schools where white children would be in the majority to be able to then sell to Mercedes executives. At least that's what the people that I interviewed said, that these are schools that would be attractive to people working at Mercedes.
Hmm. And these things were all just kind of being arranged in secret meetings?
Absolutely. So part of what my reporting showed was that there were a bunch of kind of behind-the-scenes meetings with very specifically invited elite, both black and white, to kind of plan this process and to strategize. And so the decisions to split apart the school were largely made in private and were made before the public was aware that this is what the district planned to do.
And explain the public's role in this. I mentioned, quote, angry public votes. How does that factor in here?
Well, because the committee was very torn over the decision to split apart Central. One, the school had only been around for a generation. It had taken a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to create Central, and it was indeed a powerhouse. So you had, of course, black parents afraid of what would happen once the school was split apart and would once again their children be neglected. And there were white parents who, some of them, who really wanted to see the school split apart, and others who felt that this school had provided a great education for their kids and for the community, and who also didn't want to see it split apart. And so it came down to a divided vote that mostly went down racial lines. You had students and teachers who were opposed to the district voting to break up the school, and there was a sense that school officials had already made up their minds and did not want to listen to the public.
And you mentioned that to some extent black elites have helped resegregate the schools. How so?
Well, In Tuscaloosa, the white elite definitely understood that in this county, in order to convince a judge to release it from its desegregation order, it needed to show that the black community was behind it. So they held a lot of these secret meetings with kind of a select group of black elite who supported the district, and who supported the district in exchange of getting new schools built in the black part of town. And I think the reasons why are complex. I think a lot of black leadership had kind of become disgruntled with integration. They felt that black children had borne the brunt of it, that it was black children who were on the buses for hours a day. It was black children who often they felt were segregated once they got into the schools by being tracked into kind of lower academic classes. And so they supported because there was some fatigue, and there was also a sense of inevitability that whether black leaders supported the district's efforts or not, it was going to happen. So at least this way they could get some leverage.
Well, I have to ask what the school administrators think of all of this and whether they're concerned about the effects of resegregating the school. What's happening there?
Well, to be fair, all of this happened, you know, 14, 15, 16 years ago. So much of the leadership in the Tuscaloosa schools now are not the people who made these decisions back then. They just have to deal with the decisions. But these are complicated issues. You don't want a school system that is entirely black. You do want to keep your white and middle class families invested in the schools. And how do you do that? So I think there's definitely a lot of conversations going on about it. There is a commitment. One of the things that the new superintendent did was start to ensure that some of the inequities in terms of course offerings at Central. Central didn't have physics for 10 years. It didn't have advanced placement courses. Those have been remedied. But I think there's still a lot of denial as well.
What do you think that people could learn from looking at Tuscaloosa Central High School as a case study in terms of lessons to take away for our hometown school districts?
Well, I think people should understand that these are all children, and I really focus on a young lady named Alicia Dent, who has done everything that we tell kids that they need to do if they want to be successful. She's the class president. She's the homecoming queen. She's a award-winning athlete. She's been an honor student since sixth grade, and she's behind her counterparts. And when she's taken the ACT three times trying to get a score good enough to get into a four-year college. That's not her fault. That's the fault of the schooling that she's received. And I think we need to understand that these schools remain unequal and that that's not fair.
Mm. Well, how do you intend to follow up this story? What's next for you?
Well, I'm definitely interested in heading north, north of the Mason-Dixon line, because, as I said, there is a great deal of segregation up there. And I've told the story of the South, and now I want to look into what's happening in the North.
Nicole, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Nicole Hannah-Jones of ProPublica about her new report that some American schools are resegregating.
We've got WPR's assistant news director with us in studio to talk about what's making headlines in Wisconsin this week. Hey, Noah.
Good afternoon.
So what caught your eye this week?
That's a very good question. From a news perspective, I wouldn't say it was a slow news week, but it certainly wasn't necessarily a busy one. We did get our latest job numbers for the state of Wisconsin, and this would have been for the month of March. And it had some encouraging news, actually, for the state. According to the Department of Workforce Development, the private sector in Wisconsin grew by 6,400 jobs in March. That's good because it's in stark contrast to February when the state lost around 4,000 jobs.
Right. So that's good news. And some more good news in there as regards the unemployment rate, right?
Right. Exactly. That's the real big highlight in this report. According to the DWD, the unemployment rate now stands at 5.9%, which is the lowest it's been in 5 years.
So that's, again, a positive. But as far as Wisconsin stands, I guess, in a bigger contest, in a national context, how do we look?
Right. So the progress would be slow but steady. But as you say, looking at Wisconsin in more of a national context, there's still a lot of room for improvement, frankly. According to the latest, what's called the Quarterly Census of Employment and Wages, which is a very accurate sort of survey of jobs that's released by the federal government, that showed that Wisconsin is ranked 35th in the nation for job creation. So quite a bit of distance to cover yet, although our unemployment rate is ticking downward.
All right. And so these are obviously numbers people are watching closely, the economy, the jobs bundled in with that. How do you see that factoring in as we head into election season?
Which we already are in now officially. And make no mistake, jobs are going to be one of the biggest themes we hear both on the air from advertisements from the Governor Walker and from Mary Burke, as well as their supporters. It'll be something they talk about on the campaign trail as well. And so both the politicians, their campaigns, the public certainly will be looking at these job numbers over the course of the summer and will influence, I think, the direction and certainly the tone of the campaigns.
All right. And speaking of Governor Walker and Mary Burke, there's some news, at least from the Governor Walker campaign. He's on the move.
Right. Drum roll, please. Governor Walker officially began his reelection campaign, this week, officially kicked it off with a statewide tour a little bit earlier on this week.
So a statewide tour, do you know where he went first?
He started out in Dane, and where he talked about, which is in Dane County, which he talked about the fact that he cut property taxes during his first term. He wasn't too specific about what he was going to do if he was reelected, but he did lay out some general ideas like property taxes and also, of course, touted his record.
Tell us more about what his message is so far. We know about some things he didn't say. We'll get to that in a bit. But what does he seem to be running on so far?
Sure. So he's running on his record, and there are several key themes that he struck the day that he officially launched his campaign, as well as, you know, repeatedly over the course of his term, which is he's lowered property taxes. He, according to the governor, has cut the state budget deficit. He froze tuition at UW and just recently announced that he was going to propose another tuition freeze at UW. And more broadly, he's arguing that the economy has improved under his watch. He said 100,000 new jobs were created since he took office. He said that during his campaign stops earlier this week.
Now, there was a number he didn't mention. There was this dangling 250,000 jobs.
Yes.
That has been watched by a lot of people. What is he saying or not saying about that?
Right. So this is a promise that he made during his first campaign. And I would say it's probably fair to say that it's haunted him probably since he made that pledge. The governor, when he was initially running, said that he was going to create 250,000 new jobs in Wisconsin by the end of his first term. He's nowhere near that, as I just mentioned. And both his critics and others continually point to the fact that he probably won't make it to 250,000 jobs by the time he's reelected, if he is.
So he's not emphasizing that. He is emphasizing some of the other things you mentioned earlier. And another really interesting, I guess, non-statement would be about whether or not he's running for president. I mean, in effect, what's going on there?
Right. So journalists, will ask him from time to time, are you committed to serving out another term if you are elected again? And the governor has said in the past and said again on the very day that he announced his reelection campaign that he wouldn't really answer the question. He didn't commit to fulfilling the full term. And as you mentioned, that's probably because he's believed, at least, to be considering a run for the White House in 2016.
So we'll be watching that one. Seems like not going to get a solid answer on that, but he's definitely running for governor. That's what we know right now.
We know that for sure.
All right. Well, you've had your eye on some interesting stories that I hadn't caught. This one from Superior.
Yeah, so these are one of the stories that sometimes you pick up on in the unlikeliest of places. And this was an interesting story that Mike Simonson found as he was going through the city council agenda in Superior. And he found that the city of Superior, and in fact several other communities in Wisconsin, have applied for or are receiving surplus military equipment, something called an MRAP. You have to ask me what
All
that
right,
is.
What, Noah, is an MRAP? Describe
it. An MRAP is a heavily armored, literally heavily armored, six-wheeled vehicle. It's officially called a mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, and this is something that a few departments have in the state, but more are on the way for cities like Superior.
And these are free, but I guess the question is, why does Superior need an MRAP?
So the first thing that surprised me is it's basically free to these police departments. The Army is basically offering them for free. The departments only have to pick up the bill for transportation. These MRAPs are stored right now at a depot in Texas, so it costs about $5,000. But these things cost $1 million off the line. So,
and they're how old are they? Do we know?
6-7 years old, maybe a little less. This was equipment that was developed. I wouldn't say hastily, but it certainly was developed very quickly, as far as the Pentagon is concerned, at a time when soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq were being killed and wounded by improvised IEDs, improvised explosive devices, IEDs, and the Pentagon was looking for a solution to this. And so they created these vehicles and produced them very, very quickly, produced them so quickly and in such quantities that now they have enough apparently to give away essentially for free to police departments around the country, including here in Wisconsin.
So they're in Texas right now.
Yes.
We just have to pay the towns that want them to drive them up here to Wisconsin.
Yeah, right.
And then you've got this heavily armored six-wheeled vehicle.
Right.
In Wisconsin.
That's designed to resist mines.
Exactly. So
and IEDs.
How are police departments in Wisconsin going to be using it? Do we have any idea what they have in mind?
Right. So one of the main reasons why police departments want this is because, unlike squad cars, unlike fire engines and things like ambulances, other things that you see in scenes where there may be gunfire, these are truly bulletproof. And at a time when people have access to, very powerful assault weapons, this will help not only keep officers safe, but police departments argue it also keeps civilians safe because it allows police departments to safely evacuate them if there is some kind of crisis situation. And did I mention, by the way, they're getting a heck of a deal?
Yes, a free is a pretty good deal.
Very good deal, especially for $1 million vehicle.
Wow. Have you looked up pictures of these things?
I have. Yeah, they're very...
Are they formidable?
They are formidable. And at least the police department in Superior has said clearly that these things aren't going to be on patrol.
So they're not going to be pulling over speeders.
No, they're not going to be pulling over speeders. They're simply going to be used in crisis situations.
All right. Well, that's an interesting development. And interesting to catch a sight of one if you see one driving.
Yeah, an MRAP possibly coming to a community near you.
Okay. And coming to a community near us in Milwaukee, a couple of new owners for the Bucks.
Yeah, so in sports news, former Senator Herb Kohl announced this week he was selling the Milwaukee Bucks to two hedge fund managers from New York City.
And who are these guys? What do we know about them?
Right. So their names are Wes Edens and Mark Lassery. And according to Kohl, he received at least 9 offers for the team. But he settled on these two gentlemen for a price tag of $550 million.
9 offers. That's pretty good. Do we know anything about why these two gentlemen, as you said, were selected?
Yeah, I think there's a few reasons. Wes Edens had indicated that he has family connections to Wisconsin. His mother is from here. And he and Mr. Lassery also indicated that Wisconsin is a great sports market in general, which, of course, we know from the Packers it is. And they said that it's a good deal. It's a good value. And Wisconsin is a great place to own a team.
And this has been something that's been in the works for a while. And there's also been the issue of a possible new arena. Do we know about how those things might come together?
Right. So when we talk about the Bucks, we have to talk about this idea of building a new arena in Milwaukee. And the prospective owners have committed to spending $100 million towards a new arena in Milwaukee. Herb Kohl has committed to spending $100 million. And so I'd say certainly this sale has given that effort to build a new arena certainly a boost at the very least.
All right. Do you have any sense of how it's going down in Milwaukee?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it still leaves, something like $200 million left to raise for a new arena. And so the question was, and frankly remains, how much, if any of that, is going to be from public money? How much public money is going to be used to build it? And that's still very much an open question because that $200 million needs to be found somewhere.
Somewhere else. So that's some more money that needs to come in before that can be committed to.
Exactly.
So that'll be interesting to watch as well. Do you have any idea about when a handoff might happen or is a done deal?
Yeah, well, we should say prospective owners
because
officially the NBA owners still have to approve the sale. All indications are that will happen and it'll happen in the next few days.
Okay, well, that's something we'll be watching, too. Excellent. Well, thank you for that, Noah. And I'm going to follow up on an early interview that we had. It said about I'm having trouble making conversation, and we're out of time now. So I got to ask you, what kind of car did your parents drive?
The earliest car I can remember was a brown Chevy. I don't remember the model number, but I do remember the second car we had, which was a silver Volvo station wagon. I believe it was a 1986, and it was a great car. I miss it.
See, that was fascinating. They were right. It is interesting to ask people about their parents' cars. I come from a long line of Oldsmobiles, by the way.
Oh, I wouldn't have thought that.
Yeah, you're looking at me differently, I know. No judgment, please.
No judgment zone.
All right, Noah, thanks a lot for coming by.
My pleasure, thanks.
We've been talking to Noah Ovshinsky, our assistant news director.